This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
So, Mona asked me to talk about Theory U, and I love to talk about it because the thing that drew me to it was it very much mirrors the spiritual journey. And so we want to look at both of those maps. One is the myth of eternal return, and the other is the Sharmer's Theory U. But you can see the title of our little talk is Moving from Fear to Love. So when you hear that title, Moving from Fear to Love, what comes up for you? Any questions, images? Symbols. The never ending journey, yes. A pilgrimage, yeah. So when I was creating this, we all know like the last 2 weeks have been a very hard time for all of us. So much loss and grief and sadness. And I think grief and fear are pretty much related. And how do we move out of that into love? And, you know, Alan Jones, who was the dean of the cathedral in San Francisco for years, said, we are made by love for love. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today comes from these two books. This first one is a little tiny book by Ilia DeLeo. Are any of y'all familiar with her? So she? Oh, I'm sorry. Ilia DeLeo. And she has written a lot. I first got introduced to her through Richard Rohr at one of his conferences she was speaking. And if you like Richard Rohr, you'd probably like her work. She's a big proponent, teacher of Teilhard de Chardin's work too. And this, y'all might be interested to know about these little books there. I didn't know about it till I was looking up on Amazon. I was looking up on Amazon, Ilia DeLeo, and this My Theology series came up. And there are a whole bunch of different people who have a little theology, like Cynthia Bourgeau and Joan Chittister have these little books, and they're only like 89 pages. So if you want to just get like a quick overview of their theology, these are really interesting little books. On Amazon.
I know, but do you just got the author?
If you put My Theology, I bet that series will come up. And hers, I love the title, The Primacy of Love. You know, because I think all of us know that that's what we're here for, but it's so easy to forget with everything that's going on in the world. And then the other book is The Essential Theory U, by Otto Sharmer, of course. He's an economist at MIT, and he has a huge tome called Theory U, where he first introduced that theory. But as he says in this book, people said, okay, now why don't you write a book that people can understand? So this is like Cliff Notes to Theory U, and it's, I mean, I really shouldn't say that because as an English teacher, I always hated Cliff Notes, but it really breaks it down and you can get the essence of Theory U. It's a wonderful little book if you're interested in that. So since we're saying maps for the journey, one of the questions is where are we going? What is the journey to? So we have, I brought you this poem by Mary Oliver. Probably everybody who's interested in poetry at all knows this poem. In fact, I think this poem was the poem that introduced Mary Oliver to the world. It certainly was the first poem that I ever read by her. And you can, when you read it, if you don't already know it, you'll see why it's such a popular poem. So she's talking about the journey, and when we read this poem, think about how does it answer the question, where are we going? So she says, one day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Okay, so how many of y'all have seen this poem before? A couple of y'all. Since a lot of you haven't seen it before, I'm going to see if one of y'all would like to read it. And then just think about what is standing out in the poem for you. How is it speaking to you? Maybe somebody who's read it, who is familiar with it, would like to read.
I'll read it. Okay. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began through the voices around you. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. In my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind cried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations. Though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough. In a wild night. And the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save.
Thank you, Robin. Okay, so on this journey from fear to love, you can say, yeah, we're going from fear to love, but what does that mean? What are we really journeying toward?
Ourselves?
Yeah, our true selves, the deepest, truest part of us. And so Sharma's Theory U really gives us a map on how to get there. Let's see where I put my little thing. Here it is. So I could never find the exact little slide I wanted of the ego self axis, but it's a term that comes from John Sanford, who was an Episcopal priest and a Jungian analyst. And Sanford had this very simple little diagram. And he had a circle to represent the totality of who we are. Totality of self, capital S self. And over here and there he has ego. And then right here, he has true self. Or as a Jungian, he would have said, das self, the essence of who we are. And Sanford said, there's a connecting point between these two. And he called that the ego self axis. So what this means is all through our lives, we're trying to figure out who are we really? What's our true identity? And the culture teaches us it's this pretty much, you know. So our journey is, how do we know that we're so much more than this? Cynthia Bourgeau says we all suffer from a case of mistaken identity. We don't know who we really are. Richard Rohr says, all the problems in the world come from the illusion of the separate self. By that, we think that's who we are and that's all we are. That's an illusion. None of us are separate. We're all connected. We're all one. And we know that's what our faith teaches us. But as we go through life, all our teachers, Jesus especially, was saying, who am I really? And how does this collapse into this? Now, it's not that the ego is bad or that we want to get rid of it. We absolutely need it to function in the world. But do we want the source of who we are to be coming from this or from this? Obviously, we prefer it to come from this. Sharmer's work tries to answer that question and to show us how we can operate from this place, the connected place between the two, rather than just this. Sharmer talks about moving from ego systems to ecosystem. Ego to ego. So economics, he's an economist, that's the whole house, all of us. Ego to ego. So, as I said, I've been reading Ilya Delio, and what do we mean by the primacy of love? She says, quoting Teilhard, the physical structure of the universe is love. So in other words, everything is about love. And we can think about what are the things that make us forget that? Why are we always forgetting that? She also says love is a passionate force at the heart of the universe. According to Teilhard, the core energy of cosmic life, a unit of principle, a cosmological force. And by that, she means love is brought what brought the cosmos into existence. So Teilhard indicated that love is an energy present from the Big Bang onwards. Again, the creative force is love. So to create is to bring into being. Creativity is unitive and dynamic. Unitive and dynamic. Why is all this important? Because this is work we're all supposed to be doing. Love is outgoing, relational, and self-gift. So everything in the universe is relational. No separate thing works on its own. And we have the perfect example of that through the Trinity. So to say that God is Trinity is to say that God is always in the dynamic movement of love. It's a constant giving and receiving of love throughout eternity. And many theologians teach that by virtue of the incarnation, we're all caught up in that love. And that's one of the key things here is Cynthia Bourgeau and Ilya Delio and Richard Rohr and many other theologians talk about how essential it is for us to do our part. That the universe cannot evolve without us. So again, Ilya Delio says, God and the world are intertwined in creative union, each in its own way exists in itself and with the other, so that the creative movement of life is always toward the fullness of love. And we can't really be who we are. We can't grow into the fullness of our own identity except in relationship. Again, there's no such thing as the separate self. It's a big illusion in the culture, but it doesn't exist. So Ilya says the world is not created ex nihilo, out of nothing. The world's created ex amore, out of the infinite love of God. What do you think about that? Do you agree with that?
So.
Yeah, I hope so too. But just think for a minute. This sounds really good, but if it's not true in your experience, then it's not going to be very meaningful for you. So
I think it's hard to remember that.
Yes.
Right now, especially.
Yes, it is. So think for a moment. How is this true in my own experience, that the world is created out of the infinite love of God? and that we're always moving toward the fullness of love. It's real hard to see sometimes, you know, just like the week we've been through. But where do you see it in your own life? Maybe you want.
In family.
In your family, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the challenge is to try and find it in various times.
Yes.
I mean, but you know, one of the things that I am struggling with is I recognize the need to love and support. So I can only control myself. That's so unique. So how do I manage the people who aren't thinking the same thing? Mm-hmm. You know, but I have to live with that.
It is hard. And it's also hard for us to be vulnerable enough to receive that love from others because we don't have on this armor. So, again,
contrary to everything that's in our world today, though. I mean, it just seems like we're so selfish and so protective that
It's very countercultural. Christianity is very countercultural. Love one another. You know, that how do we see in the circumstances we've been living through with a pandemic and these shootings and all this stuff, how do we see the problem? What's the problem that causes us not to live out of this love?
Fear.
So what were some things that we could do that showed we love one another and want to take care of each other just in the pandemic? Any ideas? Any things you did? Yes.
Well, the church has called people to check on everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Form connections even when we were separated.
Yes. So looking out for each other, especially when we're all isolated. Anything else?
I think sometimes just acknowledge another person, whether it's in the grocery store line or wherever, just to acknowledge that you are a person.
The smile, yeah. Because we all know that when somebody smiles at you, you get this big rush of hormones. What are they called? Oxytocin or something like that. It sounds like that drug, but it is you know, when someone looks at you and smiles, it definitely has a physical effect on you. And so just as y'all are pointing out, acknowledging one another.
When you're wearing masks, then you...
It's hard, but you can tell when people smile through their eyes. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't want to get into a political thing here, but a lot of people felt like wearing masks was a sign of love for each other, or even getting a shot was a sign of love for each other, because in that way of thinking, you're doing your part to stop the spread of this, to try to bring it to an end. So there are lots of ways of loving kindness. And the other thing is to accept if someone is not wearing a mask and you think they should be, but to still accept them and vice versa. That's the hard part.
Respect is a big part.
Hmm?
Respect.
Yes. Yes. Hmm? Okay. So Jesus coming in the incarnation is the fullness of divine love. Ilia Delio says, I love this idea that God's heart full of love explodes in the Big Bang. And if we stop and think about that we live and move and have our being in Christ, what does that mean? In love. So we're all swimming in this big pool of love. And how do we demonstrate that? Jesus taught us we're caught up in this divine relational flow of energizing love. Just think about that for a minute. Even close your eyes. Do you really believe that? So it's pretty good news, isn't it? Caught up in this divine relational flow of energizing love. Now, this is important because this is showing how we have a role to play. You know, we're not just passive here. And this is Ilya Delio, and of course, Teilhard de Chardin made a huge thing about if we are evolving to, let's say, the primacy of love, it's not going to happen just by some puppeteer God up in the sky somewhere. It's only going to be happening as we demonstrate that, as we live into that. She says, where there is movement and love, there is God. And where there is God, there is the infinite lure of love. And St. Augustine said that all desires lead us ultimately to God. So desire is an important thing. He even says, if you have a desire for a new purse, don't think of it as a bad thing, because that's just maybe the first step. Where is your desire going to ultimately lead you? So I love this thing from Ilya. She says, in each new relationship, we bring new forms of love into existence. Now, what about that? How does that work in your own life? In each new relationship, we bring new forms of love into existence. One thing that's telling me is that every relationship we have is a little bit different demonstration of love. You know, we love our spouse in a different way than we love our children. We love our fellow congregants at church in a different way than we might love our people at work. But if we're all loving, we're bringing more and more love into existence. That should be empowering to you, because it says that each interaction that you have in traffic, in the grocery store, if you choose to do the loving thing instead of, why is this fool in front of me taking so long? They're in the express line with 10,000 groceries, you know, which I've done before, or what is this person on Mopac cutting me off for? You know, those are kind of our, you know, ego response. But how do we keep training ourselves to kind of move in from the true self, the ego true self response? She says, love differentiates one from the other because only in union with another is my true self revealed. What about that? You cannot become who you are going through life, as Richard Rohr says, accessorizing the ego. So we all spend a lot of time just accessorizing our egos. But what really is bringing us into true self is relationship. And it can be a very close relationship with a spouse or a parent or a child, but it's all of these little relationships. Every single one is bringing more love into being. Yes.
And it's maybe unfair, but when this person talks about ego, do they mean the public self, or what do they mean by ego?
By ego, now remember I said ego is not bad, we're not trying to get rid of ego. But by ego, our ego is kind of like an operating system to get through the world. You know, so I won't walk outside and step in front of a truck. And so ego is not bad. But the only thing that makes it difficult for us is if we forget all of this exists and we're only operating out of this. And then we would call that an egocentric place.
There's kind of a narrow view.
Yes. Yeah. It's the view from the separate self, which of course is an illusion. What is it about our culture that makes us think that we're all separate from each other?
It's kind of the independent spirit of our country, I think, nurtures that, to pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah, the Horatio Alger American dream, which was nothing wrong with it. But if you forget that nobody gets to any success or even gets up in the morning without support from tons of other people, who made your alarm clock, you know, where'd you get those eggs for breakfast? Okay, so she's saying to grow in love is to grow into my own identity. It's to grow into freedom. How do love and freedom go together?
True self.
True self, yeah. Because you're much freer operating from true self. So the story John Sanford always talked about to illustrate what he meant by the ego-self axis is in the Gospel of John, and Pharisees asked Jesus what to do about this woman they caught in adultery. And, you know, at that time, what was the punishment for adultery?
Stoning
to death. So they know that Jesus isn't going to be for that, but they know that that's the law, so they're trying to catch him. So if you remember in the story, does Jesus answer right away? No. What does he do?
He
bends down and writes something in the sand, but we never know what it is. Sanford says what he's doing is giving himself a moment to not just react from an egocentric space, like these guys are out to get me, let me lash back, but instead to make that connection to true self and answer from that place. And what does he say when he answers from that place? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Probably everybody knows that Bible verse if you don't know any other one, you know? So what a brilliant answer, but it did not come from a defensive ego, you know? Okay. So these maps that we're gonna talk about help us, I think, to live in that loving space. We know that we can't do it all the time. We're just, that's who we are, but we can probably do better. And so the two maps I wanted to look at, this is a really basic thing that you've probably seen a bunch of times. For one thing, it's the church liturgical year, but it's called Myth of Eternal Return because it's based on the sun. You know, you can imagine a primitive society and it's getting darker and darker. Up top, see summer solstice, super light, lightest day of the year. So the unconscious is a light, innocence, naivete. We could think of that like the Garden of Paradise. Everything's great, no problem. And that word naivete is like, yeah, well, just wait. You know, it seems fine right now, and it is. But then...
So what about the dichotomy between other-directed and self-directed? So you talk about self-conscious, unconscious, ego-conscious, but nothing's talking about other-directed as opposed to self-directed.
So unconscious would be, I always like to use this shows how old I am, but it was from a Woody Allen movie. I can't remember which one it was, but you know how the Woody Allen's character is always worried about everything and an existential fit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's in one scene, this little beautiful kind of couple are strolling along, just chattering and happy. And he's saying, yeah, look at them. They're totally unconscious. That's why they're happy. So that's what it means by this innocence and naivete. Oh, yeah, everything's fine. Well, we see that a lot, you know, when somebody can be in a place of privilege in the society and they don't know what it's like to be poor or to be discriminated against because they're, you know, in their own little world. So that's why that they put unconscious there. But then when you get to right here,
okay.
Sometimes we say this is the Holy Spirit is the gatekeeper there.
Okay.
Because what happens is something usually bad, hurtful, painful,
okay.
makes us go, wait a minute, maybe everything's not perfect. So let's say you get divorced, somebody dies, you lose your job, you know, any of the terrible things that have been happening. And you're like, wait a minute, there's something else going on here. So you fall into chaos and disequilibrium. And that just means that everything you were so sure of up here that seemed like, you know, I've got to figure it out. I'm fine. When you fall down here, it's like, wait a minute. That none of that makes any sense anymore. I really don't know where I am. I don't know what to believe. Now, we could certainly say when something happens, like what happened in Uvalde, that can send us as a culture down here. Or sorry, can send us as an individual. Like, wait a minute, how can something this terrible happen? You know, I'm sure all of y'all, just like I was, were just in grief and despair for the last 2 weeks thinking about that. And then, of course, not only that, but it brings up every other horrible thing that's happened in these mass shootings. So let's just say we could fall down into here as an individual or even as a group or a culture and say, something's wrong. We thought everything was just fine, but there's something wrong, and how do we fix it? People can debate on how to fix it, but you're right. If you're like me, you're kind of like, how do we fix it? I don't know how we're going to fix it, because one side is sure they're right and the other sure is theirs right. So how are we going to fix it? So it's just this disequilibrium. Or on a personal level, let's say you lose your job unexpectedly and you're identified with your job. Let's say, gosh, I'm a teacher. I've always been a teacher. Now I lost my job. Who am I? You know, or I'm a lawyer. I've always been a lawyer, but now I don't have a law firm to work with. Who am I? Has that ever happened to any of y'all? Anything that caused you to fall into chaos and disequilibrium?
Losing a husband.
What is it?
Losing a husband.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes. Anytime we lose somebody that was our life sole partner, that's a huge one. But other things, you know, just like disruptions in the culture, like we've been talking about, or even, you know, your best friend is mean to you and quits talking to you or something. You know, all of these things can cause us to come down here. So we're kind of wandering around in the dark. The church puts Advent here because Advent is a time of emptying, letting go. You know, the word we use for that in Christianity is kenosis, emptying, letting go. Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering, is that also the same thing you did 16?
Yes, that's exactly what that is. Or it could be, you know, if you're of a certain age, that you retire and then you're like, wait a minute, who am I now? And your whole schedule used to be, you know, pretty the same every day. But now it's like, one of my friends said, every day is Saturday. So anyway, for whatever reason, things are thrown off and you're having to rethink all your assumptions about life. So here is the darkest part. You become aware, you know, you have that you have an ego. And winter solstice, what church feast is right here?
Christmas.
So why? It's like, why is that the dark? Well, because the light of the world is born here. And we're coming now back up towards the light. So we're here. Sanford says confrontation with shadow. It's our struggle to, on the spiritual journey, to move to that place of true self. Whereas we have that niggling little ego always pulling us into the separate self. Okay, so we're down here for a while, but we know there's something up there. The church puts Lent right here, crucifixion. You know, that old saying, the darkest night is right before the dawn. But then, resurrection, enlightenment. So we go, this is, you know, it's called myth of eternal return. It's based on the sun. But we go through this all the time. Unfortunately, we seem to learn from suffering, learning from mistakes, learning from grief and pain. I'm not saying that God sends us that. I don't believe that at all. But just that seems to be the way life is. And I think it's because when we are suffering or in loss and grief, we become vulnerable and open to the grace that God is giving us. When everything's going just fine and we're just, you know, walking down that street, though, you know, we're not open. We feel like we don't need any grace. We don't need anything. So I think everybody can stop and think that the times that you felt the most open and present the God that a lot of them are in times of loss. Is that right? Do you experience that? Not always, but often.
That's when you start seeking, I think. You start seeking God and answers.
Yeah. Well, and that's what this shows. You're like, now you're like seeking to get up here to find. Okay, so that's the myth of eternal return. I've always loved that since I was in seminary. Yes.
What are some of the things you said several times now that you, when you're going out of the darkness, you know that there's something else. What are some of those things that help you realize that there is one after the storm?
Well, I think we'd go back to love for that. Who picks you up when you're down here? You know, what friend kept you from just staying down there? What pastor? What novel that you read? What is it that gave you hope that could start you back up? Are there any kind of things that could do it? Usually it's somebody else reaching out in love to us. What is it?
I think that's part of the problem, right? We've been so isolated.
Yeah.
That we're missing that connection with people.
That's absolutely right. And now Mona's going like, I just wanted you to talk about 3U and you're still not on.
Well, I'll just kind of jump in and say one little thing about the myth of eternal return. The language of the Psalms kind of mirrors this too. Psalms of praise, creation, and then the Psalms of lament. And really, of the 150 Psalms, lament is the biggest category. That's kind of the darkness. And then Psalms of Thanksgiving, that's when you kind of move up out of that, you know, into the light. So you have that, this, I think, reflected in the language of Psalms.
And one of the key things is we don't want to go down here in the dark, but transformation happens in the dark. We're like, wait a minute, I want to stay up here in the light. And we talked about, you can be up here and something bad can happen. You can choose not to come down. How do you do that?
Deny.
Denial. And what helps you deny? Addiction. So let's say you have an addiction to sweets. So you're, you know, something bad happens. So you're heading out to Evercrest Bakery every day, getting a chocolate cupcakes. Or alcohol, any kind of drugs, consumerism, you know, going immediately to another relationship, just, you know, not wanting to feel any of this. It's the proverbial buying the red sports car in the midlife crisis, you know. Let me distract myself so I don't have to make this journey. But I can't get to enlightenment jumping from here to here, even though that's what we all want to do. But this is how we become the complex person, how we start understanding who we are. And we're, with grace and God's help, we can get up to the top. And then, you know, it's not a one-time deal, obviously. We're always doing it. Now, Sharmer and his theory, you can see that you still have that downward journey. He's starting over here. But what he's doing is emptying. He's, you know, he's an economist. He's not a theologian. But I've always thought of him as a mystic economist. He is, and when I was at the Cove, he was one of our guest lecturers. Just really a wonderful, loving, open, present person. But anyway, what he's saying is here, this voice of judgment, voice of cynicism, voice of fear. These are things we have to let go of. So voice of judgment is a closed mind. So he says we need an open mind. Voice of cynicism, lacking empathy is a closed heart. So we need an open heart. Voice of fear is the ego's fear of letting go and realizing that it's a bigger thing. So that's our will to come right down here. Sharmer calls this presencing. What do you think he means by presencing? Just that your computer always says you're spelling it wrong when you put that in.
Awareness.
Look, he says here, connecting to source. Connecting to source. What Stormer says is that people know a whole lot. He's talking about leaders now, but it's all of us, about what they're doing, who is doing it, and what they're doing, and how they're doing it. But what they don't know, what he calls the blind spot, is where is the source from which I am working from? So in other words, if I'm not aware of that, say I'm a leader, I'm not aware of it, I could very easily just be operating out of this ego spot. Have you ever known anybody like that? If you looked in the mirror, you probably... No, but I mean, we have some like that. It's just funny because this morning when I opened up my New York Times thing online, they had the story about Jack Welch. Y'all remember him?
Yeah.
The General Electric CEO. And I mean, I don't want to make a judgment on Jack Welch, although I guess I hate him really. But I wanted to read you just the very beginning of what they said. If you look at historical data on the US economy, you often notice that something changed in the late 70s or early 80s. Income started growing more slowly for most workers and inequality surged. David Gels, a Time reporter who has been interviewing CEOs for years, argues that corporate America helped cause these trends. Specifically, David points to Jack Welch, the leader of General Electric, who became the model for many other executives. I spoke to David about these ideas, which are central to his new book on Welch. And so what he's saying is, for decades after World War II, big American companies bent over backwards to distribute their profits widely. In General Electric's 1953 annual report, the company proudly talked about how much it was paying its workers and how much taxes it was paying. That changed with the ascendance of men like Welch, who took over as chief executive of GE in 81 and ran the company for the next two decades. Under Welch, GE unleashed a wave of mass layoffs and factory closures that other companies followed. The trend helped destabilize the American middle class. Profits began flowing not back to workers, but to big investors, et cetera, et cetera. Now, why I'm using that as an example, I'm sure Jack Welch was a wonderful person, but I'm just using him as an example here. If you are leading, instead of leading from this place, connecting to source, in other words, you can call that truth self, you can call it God, you can call it your higher self, whatever, something bigger than you are. If you're leading from that, your work can be transformative. If you are not, your work is not going to be transformative. Sharmer's whole thing here is when you're letting all of this go, you get down to the bottom. You won't get here if you don't have open mind, open heart, open will. If you're judgmental, cynic, and fearful, you will not get here. Instead of operating from this place, where will you be operating from? An egocentric, very well-defended, fearful place. That's totally antithetical to what we believe as Christians. You know, it's not just about my own little separate patty. It's about all of us. And so Sharmer's thing, you get down here, who is myself? What is my work? So he says the biggest blind spot for leaders is they don't know the source that they're operating from. If I don't know that I'm operating from a defensive ego, then how can I let go of anything and drop to a deeper place? So that blind spot is what we need to worry about. Anybody think of any leader, anybody, any example, you don't even have to know names, of somebody that you can clearly see is operating from a defensive, egocentric place instead of a more open, holistic place?
Many politicians.
Hmm?
Many of our politicians.
Yeah. I mean, we can all find a politician that we can think is doing that. And some of us might have different opinions on which politician, but still, we can find them. Anytime a politician is concerned about, I'm only going to vote on this if it's going to get me reelected. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like I can't say, well, if I vote on this, I know a lot of people that have voted for me in the first place are not going to vote for me next time. But I truly believe that the culture is going to be a lot better. People will be happier, safer, whatever it is. If I vote on this, and hey, maybe I won't get reelected next time, but that's okay. I'll do something else. We don't see that too often. Or maybe it's there, but you know, we don't get the story. And you don't have to be a politician. It could be anything. Like, if I'm in my job and I'm making decisions, am I making them for the greater good? In other words, with an open heart. In other words, empathy. How can I put myself in the shoes of the people that my decision is affecting? So anyway, if you can drop these judgment, cynicism, and fear, instead of having a closed mind, heart, and will, open that. Sharmer talks about sensing from the field. In other words, you're not just sitting there thinking, what's going to be, what's in it for me, and how am I going to get my company better? You're thinking, what is it that wants to come forth in the culture right now? What is it that will be better for a large number of people, for all the stakeholders in this decision? He calls that sensing from the field. It's not just a head thing. It's also a heart and intuitive thing. I don't know. Sharmer uses an example from that movie, The Legend of Bagger Vance. It's an old movie, I know, but did anybody else see that about the golfer? Well, the scene that he uses is the golfer is playing in this tournament, and he's a really good guy, but it's going to mean a lot to his town if he wins this tournament. I think it's in the Depression or something. But he's like, frozen up. He doesn't think he can do it. And one of the characters who plays, like the image of the source of the true self, is saying, don't think about it. Let your hands do what they want to do. I'm, probably not giving the best example of this, but if you saw the film, you get it. So instead of like overthinking, like, oh my God, how do I do the right swing here? Just let go and relax into what is it that wants to happen? Where does this ball want to go? So guess what? He does a great shot. But it was like, okay, it's not about me whether I win. It's like, where does this ball want to go? It's like that. Thomas Merton has a translation of this poem about the archer. This guy's a great archer. He never misses the target. He's wonderful. But then he gets in a contest and he can't do it anymore because in the contest, he's worried about his separate self. So those are examples. Anyway, so when we get down here, we're opening to the source. Who is myself? Capital S. This whole being. What am I called to do? What are we called to do? He has letting come. What seems to be coming when you look around at not just your little group, but a bigger field? What wants to come? Then you get a vision and intention. Then he says, act in an instant. Don't sit around, thinking and thinking and thinking. Just do something. It's a prototype. Linking head, heart, and hand. And then put it out there in the world. If it doesn't work, start over again. But, he says you can get caught up in this. Anybody that's worked for a large corporation knows how you can sit in there and these infinite meetings that go on forever. Okay, this group decided this, but now the other group has to look at it, and it just goes on and on and nothing ever happens. So can you see any similarities between myth of eternal return that we just talked about and this?
The letting go corresponds to going into the chaos and facing
the chaos. They're both journeys away from separate self to the greater whole. Again, as I said at the beginning, moving from ego to eco, from the separate self to the whole. He says eco, the root is the whole house. Okay, so I guess that's fine. This goes along with Stormers because how he says, how you attend to something has the greatest effect on the outcome of that thing, any situation, how you pay attention. I know we're running out of time. I'll just quickly zip through this. So these are the levels of listening. You can download, and that means you're just listening. You're not really listening because it's already in your head. Like, I already know what Mona's going to say. I don't need to listen to her. Mm-hmm. You don't consciously think that, but that's what you do. Okay, so that's nothing's going to happen there because you're not really listening. But the way we listen a lot is we open our mind and we say, okay, what are the facts here? Oh, that's some new data I didn't know about. So, you know, maybe I'll have to think about whether I wear a mask or not, you know, whatever. So we're open mind and you're saying, how is this disconfirming, this new data disconfirming something I believed? Do I need to look at it again? So it's facts. If you open your heart, you can listen from a place of empathy and emotional connection. So it's open heart, seeing through another person's eyes. I have to make a decision, but how is this decision going to, you know, affect a child in poverty who doesn't have enough money for lunch at school? So how does this affect somebody else? And then finally, the generative place to bring forth something new is open mind, open heart, and open will, listening from source. So we could use it this way and say, I'm listening from my ego that's very well connected to my true self. So I know it's not just about my little separate me. It's about all of us, you know, or all the stakeholders in this decision that I'm making. So Sharmer is adamant in saying, we will never get the world we want if we're not listening from this generative level, which of course includes the open mind and the open heart. Nothing new can come forward if we're not allowing ourselves to drop down, letting all this ego stuff go, so we can be connected to the source within us, within each one of us. It's the same within each one of us. One of my teachers used to look around the room and say, oh, there are now like 15 sets of eyes, which the great I am is looking at me through 15 sets of eyes now. So how do we let go of the things that keep us from listening with an open mind, open heart and will? And then we can bring something new forward into the world. Yes.
Do you think that a person can choose to do that? Or do you think the person can choose to have God transform them? Because when I choose it, it doesn't usually happen. But sometimes if I say, I choose to let you transform me, that's when it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you're saying there's a bigger thing here and I'm not in control of it. But like if we're praying before making a decision, that's what we're doing. And I definitely think we have to be open to grace. That grace will allow us to get to that place from, you know, that's the Christian language that we would use, but I think Sharmer would go right along with that because this grace is what allows us to make these connections. You know, we're not going to come up with just this ego, separate self thing, connecting to an emerging future, a whole shift in identity and self. So what I would say, this is my own opinion, but I would say that you can't get there without spiritual practice. You know, each person might have a different idea of what spiritual practice they're doing. Coming to church is a spiritual practice. Doing your meditation daily is a spiritual practice. You know, saying morning and evening prayer every day is a spiritual practice. Saying the rosary, whatever your spiritual practice is. I'm prejudiced myself to a meditation practice, but it doesn't work for everybody. But yeah. That's a really good point, Robin. You can't just say, okay, ego. Ego's in charge, and now I'm going to do this. No. It's a letting go. And I think, I used to think sometimes when I was sitting in Ascension Health meetings. I used to think, what if every one of these executives had a meditation practice? How would things be different? Maybe they did have a meditation practice, I don't know. But I couldn't help thinking, you know, like, let's say everybody in the Congress had a meditation practice. Things would probably be different. And a lot of them probably do. What was that, Tim Ryan? He's the big guy on meditation. Or they have some kind of practice that helps them. Any kind of practice that can help unblock that ego self axis is going to help us do this. So finally, ending right here. Oh, well, that's, I'm not going to go into that. We really don't have time. If you don't do this and you go instead of presencing to absencing, this is a closed mind, closed heart, and closed will. It's a road to destruction. And this is a road to creation. But you'll have to look that up on your own because we don't talk about it now. I'm going to end with this poem by William Stafford. You've probably seen it before. It's a famous poem, The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. So the thread, what do you think the thread is? There's no one right answer. What do you think the thread is?
Grace.
The what?
Grace.
Grace, uh-huh.
Your connection with the universe, with God.
Mm-hmm. I think the thread is whatever, it could be any of your spiritual practices that keep you connected to that grace. You know, I mean, all of us are letting go of the thread all the time because we get caught up in our egos and we get defensive and all. But he's just saying, what you call the thread might be different than what you call the thread and what I call the thread, but it is the constant. I would say the thread is love, which just brings us back to the primacy of love. So, Ilya Delio, remember, a miracle happens anytime you move from fear to love. So that's a good little talisman to hold on to when you're having to make a decision, when you're about to shoot the finger at somebody on MOPAC. What helps you act from a loving place instead of a fearful place? Because, you know, what is the only thing we have that can conquer fear? Love. So if we stay in that place of presencing, that place of wholeness, we won't be afraid. It's when we ego takes over and we forget who we are. So I'm glad y'all all came to St. David's Church today to help strengthen that ego self-axis. And thank you for listening.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.